Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Reva Winkler from the National Quality Forum. Here with me at NQF is Suzanne Taberge and Gene Cunningham of the project staff, and Heidi Bosley is the Vice President of Performance Measures. We welcome you all to this first work group meeting for our perinatal endorsement maintenance project. We think we've got most of the steering committee members here, and we're going to want to do introductions and disclosures, but also any of the other steering committee members who are not on this work group but may wish to listen in, certainly welcome. We'd like to also have you just introduce yourselves as we go through. So let's start with just going through the list. First one is Laura Riley. Laura, would you just introduce yourself and make any statements around disclosures?
Okay. This is Laura Riley. I'm a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Mass General, and I'm a longtime participant in this process with ACOG, and I'm also on the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine Specialists, and I don't have any specific disclosures.
Right. In terms of disclosures, we're looking for any involvement in the major development or anything that might give you a bias towards the evaluation of the measure. So that's the kind of thing we're looking for from folks. All right, Barbara Kelly.
Hi, I'm here. I'm a family physician with the University of Colorado. This is my first experience with this group, and I have no disclosures.
Okay, thank you very much. Lee Partridge.
This is Lee Partridge. I'm a senior health policy advisor with the National Partnership for Women and Families, a national consumer advocacy organization. And I have served on a number of NQF and NCQA committees, and including the perinatal committee that preceded this work 3 years ago with Laura Riley.
Great. Thank you, Lee. Is Sharon Sutherland with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. Hi, Sharon. Do you think you could introduce yourself and make any statements around disclosures of interest, please?
Yes. I am with the Cleveland Clinic. I'm a staff OBGYN, and I'm the Quality Improvement Officer for Women's Health Institute, which covers OBGYN services at all Cleveland Clinic facilities. I have no disclosures.
Great. Thank you. Kathleen Pinson? Kathleen?
Yes, I'm a perinatal clinical specialist at Mercy Hospital in St. Louis. I did participate on the original committee with Drs. Riley and Partridge, and I was also on the Joint Commission Technical Advisory Panel that selected the subset of measures. I have no other disclosures.
Thank you, Kathleen. Janet Young?
Hi, I'm Janet Young. I'm an emergency physician at Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. I am the forensic nurse examiner medical director here, and this is the first time I've represented ASEP and my first time working for the NQF, and I have no disclosures to state.
All right. Is Sarah Brown with us yet? Sarah said she'd be a little bit late. We'll capture her when she joins us. Are there any other steering committee members on the call listening in? Okay, some of them have indicated they might join us. We also have with us several measure developers for the measures that we are going to be discussing, and I think we'll introduce you as we discuss each measure.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
This is Sarah.
Oh, great. Hi, Sarah. Thanks. Glad she could join us. Would you introduce yourself and make any statements of disclosure of interest, please?
My name is Sarah Brown. I'm the CEO of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy.
Okay. Any disclosures?
About what?
Any conflicts with the measures or any financial interests with the measures?
None at all.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. So that means we've got everybody from the work group. For what we're going to do today is discuss five measures that have been submitted for evaluations. Four of these measures are measures that have been previously endorsed by NQF and are undergoing their maintenance review. One measure is a new submission that has not been evaluated previously. On the webinar, we are showing the measure submission forms as we discuss the measures. Just to let you know, NQF is having some technical issues with limited bandwidth these days, so there is a bit of a lag. If you have your own version of the submission form, it might be easier for you to use that, and feel free to do so. The other bit of information is the results of the initial preliminary evaluations that the work group has done via the SurveyMonkey tool, and the summary results were sent to you earlier today. If you haven't had a chance to look at them, that's fine. I've got a copy sitting right in front of me, and we'll talk about them as we go through the measures and the different criteria. So just to let you know what our intention is today is we do want to get through all five measures, which means we've got to spend about 20 minutes per measure. This is meant to do a couple of things. It's to help us help you all become familiar with the NQF criteria, to become familiar with the measures, to share the experience of a preliminary evaluation of the six of you and how you're viewing the measures, find out where you're agreeing, where you're not agreeing, have an opportunity to discuss and bring those issues out. The measure developers are available to answer your questions if perhaps you need issues clarified or further explained. And so this is a chance to just kind of come together around the information on these measures in anticipation of the final evaluation and recommendations to be made at our in-person meeting on November 29th and 30th. So, and I think that given this is a first experience for many of you, I'm going to kind of lead you through it with some questions to help sort of get you started in your discussion. I think all members of the work group should feel very comfortable to jump in and add to the discussion. We have assigned a lead discussant for each measure, not to put anybody on the spot, but to sort of share the load. In this case, we have more work group members than we do measures, but we will hope that the other folks will jump in and join in the conversation. So that's our plan for today. Does anybody have any questions about what we're going to be doing or any questions about the materials we're going to be referring to? Okay.
Suzanne? Sorry, this is Barb Kelly. I'm trying to get it up online.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see what you're doing. Are you showing things online?
On the webinar, you should see the agenda.
Okay, and where is it? I can't find the email that's got the link in it.
The webinar is myeventpartner.com/qualityforum202. It's right at the top of the agenda. It's also on the work
file. I'll try to type it in. Thank you.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that again? We're supposed to be on a webinar format now?
Well, you could be. You can either view the submission form on a webinar, or you can view it yourself. We're going to be using the measure submission forms.
And where do I find those submission forms again? Because I don't see it in my webinar.
I'm only showing the agenda at the moment. The submission forms are all on the SharePoint, and I'll pull them up as we go. So once we get to a measure, I'll pull up the form. Right now, it's just the agenda.
Thank you.
Is everybody else okay?
If you have a question or comment over the telephone, please press star 1. The participant lines are muted.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's move on to the first measure then. The first measure is measure 502. This is a measure, the title is Pregnancy Test for Female Abdominal Pain Patients. This is brought to us from the American College of Emergency Physicians. It is the percentage of female patients aged 14 to 50 who present to the emergency department with a chief complaint of abdominal pain for whom a pregnancy test is ordered. So I believe this measure received time-limited endorsement in 2008, and so this is the first review since that time. A time-limited endorsement meant that the measure passed all of the criteria except for the testing for reliability and validity. So on this follow-up maintenance review, we will expect to see testing information and results. So I believe, Janet, you were the lead discussant for this, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if you had a chance to read through, and I do have ratings on this from all six of the work group members. So why don't we start talking about your thoughts on the importance criteria? The first one, of course, is impact. The second is opportunity for improvement. And the third one is evidence for the measure process.
Okay. So when I initially saw this this quality measure, I thought, wow, this is pretty much a no-brainer. I'm not exactly sure why we're reevaluating it, but we'll look at it again. And so I did a fairly large analysis of the literature, going back to actually the 1980s when urine pregnancy tests and rapid pregnancy testing started. American Journal of OBGYN actually published their first data in 78. So as far as impact, abdominal pain is the third most common chief complaint for presentation to both urgent and emergency care. So it has a very large number of patients and a substantial impact on patient populations, especially those who don't present to their primary care office for either planned prenatal care or follow-up prenatal care. So from an impact perspective, it's actually quite a large group of patients.
Great. Super. Any other comments from other work group members? Okay, why don't you look at opportunity for improvement, 1B?
1B, for opportunity for improvement, I don't know actually what's being reported right now as in terms of how many patients are actually getting a pregnancy screening for chief complaint of abdominal pain, so this is one of the holes in my own knowledge, and I don't know if the original submission from ASEP actually addressed performance and how that has been reported on either a hospital or a clinic basis. Maybe you can fill me in on that.
Yes. Anybody else from the work group want to jump in? The submission form does discuss a paper published by Shure that looked at a national database of U.S. Emergency departments, as well as a chart review of four Northeastern academic emergency departments. And there was a bit of a discrepancy in the national database. The performance was about 67%. In the chart review, it was it ranged from 89 to 95%, I believe, when I read the article.
Okay, and that article was by Shure?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so just based on the information that you're giving me with a 67% from a national database to a 90-something percent local ED chart review, I certainly think that there's potential for improvement, but I think that we need to get more data for this particular criteria.
Okay, Janet, are you looking at the measure evaluation form?
I am looking at what you have on the webinar right now.
Go down to the bottom of page 2.
Okay,
so there's the description of the study. Also, because this did seem to be a significant one, I pulled that study and I posted it to SharePoint.
Thank you.
Excuse me, is there any way that, where do we go on SharePoint to go back to the original statement
not find that information at all.
Pardon me?
On the SharePoint, I could not find the original submission.
Yeah, where's the original statement of this measure?
The originally endorsed measure or the measure, the submission that we're looking at right now?
The submission you're looking at right now. How do we get to that?
It's on the, if you go to the SharePoint site and then you go to measure shared documents, it's under work group 1.
Okay, wait a second.
And it's also in the all measure folder as well.
Agenda work group 1.
You should also see the measure forms in that folder.
Well, listed are the work group, TB work group 1 results, then agenda work group 1, then 1769 adverse outcomes. So
it should be in there. It's number 502.
Okay, got it.
Great. Okay. And right now we're looking at the bottom of page 2.
Okay. So, Janet, can you see the data on the bottom of page 2?
I can. On the webinar, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Make it a little bigger here.
So we'll make it as big as we can.
I'm really sorry. I still can't pull it up. I see the document. I'm clicking on it, and it won't come up.
The title is listed twice. You want to click on the one that's on the left-hand side. It should be if you can't get it now, maybe we can talk you through it after, since we have a limited time for each semester.
Okay.
Actually, after this meeting, if somebody could just send it to me in a separate document so I can jump it into a file folder, that would be great.
We can't look at it online now. Is that what you're saying?
No. You are looking at it online.
No. I'm on SharePoint, and it says 502 pregnancy test for female abdominal pain. There's a Word document icon to the left of it and a box to check, but it won't.
Oh, no, don't check the box. Just click on the title, and that should ask you if you want to open it.
It asked me that. I say yes, and then it doesn't open it. Never mind.
Okay.
Can you see it on the webinar?
This is Lee. I couldn't get it on the webinar, so I'm looking at it on SharePoint.
I can't get on SharePoint, so I don't know.
Am I interfering with anybody else? Can we all access
it? No, it should. You should all be able to open it at once. Jean's going to send an email to the work group members with the measure forms right now, so just give it a couple minutes. It'll be in your inbox shortly.
All right, and just as a suggestion, seems to me every time we're having a call, that would be a very easy thing to do, is to send the phone number again and the documents that we're going to be discussing in their own self-contained email.
Well, we're trying to keep everything on SharePoint we've had a lot of trouble in the past with people not getting our emails because we have too many attachments. I can definitely send the numbers and the web login information every time before the call, but
I understand that, but you have to. I'm now on SharePoint trying to open it.
No, Sarah, you're right. We'll try multiple ways until we get some of the technical issues ironed out. Okay. So Janet, you're able to look at the measure evaluation form, correct?
I am. I'm actually looking at the bottom of page 2 on the webinar.
Right.
502.
Right. Okay.
With the article on SURE.
Right.
So based on that data, again, I haven't done a new data review as of today, but I will by the next time we talk. With 67% of EDs checking pregnancy tests for a female abdominal pain presentation, I think there's a very large improvement possibility. I think based on the confidence intervals on women with ectopic pregnancy, we certainly have an excellent opportunity for improvement.
Okay.
Reva, do you want us to
talk? Absolutely.
Okay.
If you'd like to contact other members of the work group, this is purpose of this.
I made a note to myself on this one that the developer recommended additional study before widespread implementation of this measure, and I think that I gather that stemmed from the fact that of the two studies, the differences were so significant. And based on that, I found that I was questioning whether or not this was not a measure that was ready for being continued, in essence, because it was time-limited originally.
Do we have the measure developers with us?
Hey, Emily Graham is here. I'm not sure if Jay Scher is on the line or not.
Okay, Emily. Do you have any comments in response?
I wish that Dr. Scher was on the line so that he could speak to this from a clinician perspective. I'm filling in as staff.
Okay. I'm on the line now. They had muted me.
Okay, great.
Jay Scher, I'm an emergency physician and was involved with the team that developed this and did one of the validation studies. We cited two pieces of evidence in our measure reapplication. The first was our study, And that looked at two things. It looked at a national database, the NHAMCS, which is what showed 67%. But then we also did a chart review at four hospitals, and we found a much smaller gap with around 90% of appropriate patients getting a pregnancy test. A second validation study was done by Dr. Graf at a community hospital in Connecticut, and they found a significant gap and improvement after they implemented a QI project. And so we think there is a gap associated with it. That's why we reapplied for the measure. I guess in general, the American College of Emergency Physicians feels that, you know, measures should be well tested, and so I think at this point it's been tested in four or five different EDs, but has not had a large national test.
Okay.
This is Sarah. This is one of my principal concerns about it, and Reba, maybe you can help us. In general, is this amount of data considered adequate for a measure? I thought it was inadequate, but I may be wrong.
I think that's a judgment call for the committee. We don't have any absolute threshold. So does anybody else have anything they want to add about opportunity for improvement? We certainly have some data. In terms of the pre-ratings, it's kind of across the board. Of the six work group members, two rated high, two rated at medium, and two rated at low. So I think this is an area, I think, of some concern. There doesn't seem to be lots of data or the discrepancy between the national study and the four community hospital study does pose some questions about the significance of the opportunity for improvement. So I think this is one area, and that's one factor in the importance criteria. Why don't we move on to the third one, which is the evidence. And in this case, we're looking for the evidence that ordering a pregnancy test affects patient outcomes, or what is the relationship between ordering a pregnancy test and patient outcomes? Anna, did you want to start us off?
I can start us there, actually, and then I would love to have your... This was, for me, the kind of the crux of why we're looking at the measure outcomes. And I believe this is in page four. Can we go to the next page on the webinar?
Yeah, go to me. Yep.
All right, it should be showing up now.
Sorry, this is measure 1C.
No, measure 502.
Yeah, no, I'm just hunting for the subset.
Oh, 1C1.
1C1, yeah.
Thank you. By ordering a pregnancy test, are we improving patient outcomes? And I think that there's been some very good historic literature that in patients who get pregnancy tests for acute evaluation of abdominal pain, we rule in or rule out a gynecologic emergency relatively quickly, or we investigate further if there's a positive pregnancy test. And I'm not sure right now, based on the literature review that I've done, that I have the specific studies that tell us that there's an improved outcome. I know that there's no NHANES or NCs, the national database information on that, and maybe Dr. Scher can speak to that point about a specific study that has determined a cohort group of patients who've gotten abdominal pain workups without a pregnancy test versus those who have, and what those outcomes are. But the standard of care certainly has been, at least in the emergency medicine and the urgent care literature, to provide a pregnancy test for any patient who's presenting with acute abdominal pain. And I'll leave it there because I would like to hear lots of other feedback.
Dr. Scher, did you want to comment?
Sure. I would agree with the comment that this is considered standard of care, and so there have not been any prospective trials looking at different evaluation strategies with or without pregnancy tests. The concern and the reason why the measure was developed initially came from risk management experience that emergency physicians and insurers that they work with have, that missed or delayed diagnosis of ectopic pregnancy is a significant cause of adverse events and risk management events.
Right. Okay.
This is Dr. Sutherland. I guess the best corollary I can think of is the pre-op HCG.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we do it routinely before we take a patient to surgery, and we're not going to structure a study in which we start operating on women without knowing if they're pregnant or not. So I think, you know, we have to realize that there might be a paucity of evidence because it's not ethical to consider structuring a study like that.
Okay. Any other comments from any other work group members?
Can I ask a question? This is Sarah.
Sure.
What's the schedule for re-examining existing measures? Is it every 4 years?
3 years.
3 years. So presumably 3 years ago, whoever the selection committee members were or process, all these issues have been resolved to their satisfaction. Is that right?
Well, I think that time kind of works in multiple dimensions, and the criteria that we're now looking at measures, I think, are more specific, particularly around evidence. What was the work of the evidence task force last year? So we're being a little bit more focused on the evidence and the relationship to outcomes than perhaps they were 3 years ago.
Well, you know what I'm wondering is, you know, I think one of the themes here is that we're kind of feeling we don't have adequate data, or may not. But what I'm wondering is, maybe 3 years ago a boatload of information was looked at and reviewed, and the fact that there's only one or two more since then may or may not make much of a difference if the original bibliography was really large and intense.
I can comment. For this measure, that was not the case. There really is very little published about this, and the studies that we cite were done in response to this measure to try to develop some evidence around it. The only prior study we found in the United States was actually a study by Dr. Burstyn in the late 90s, and that was cited in the original application.
So that means maybe that the standards of evidence have gotten tougher now.
Well, from NQF's perspective, they've become more explicit in terms of the fact we're looking at the body of evidence, we're looking at the quantity, quality, and consistency. So there is a sharper focus,
right,
on outlining the evidence, yes.
This is Kathleen. I was on the committee last time. I don't recall this measure. Was it in another group?
It was in another project, yes.
Oh, okay.
It was an emergency room project. But one thing I'll note in looking at the evaluations that the work group did beforehand, three of the members have rated the evidence as low. Would either of the three of you like to comment on that?
Well, I'm one of them. It's not so much low, meaning low in quality. It's just there's not very much.
Okay, so low in quantity.
I probably screwed it up. But I just would have the general feeling that in order to approve a measure that, you know, is going to take people time to, you know, fill out and think about and disseminate and respond to in an orderly way, that we probably would want a deeper bench. That's why I'm asking sort of what the expectation is.
Sorry, this is Dr. Young again. When I was doing my Cochrane database review and my PubMed review, most of the data around pregnancy testing, especially rapid pregnancy testing, is from the mid-80s, and I have not been able to wade through in the last 7 days, because I've only been able to work on this for 7 days, to wade through all of that information. And there may actually be some better data out there. I can't speak to that yet, and I do need more time. This was just a very compressed time format for me.
Okay.
So I'll be able to speak to that a little bit further in the next couple of days.
All right. Any other thoughts from those of you who had rated this low? One question I would ask is, the specification for this is that the pregnancy test is ordered, why would it not be the pregnancy test was performed?
Good point.
Sorry, doctor, go ahead and answer.
So initially, the measure was developed, I think, with the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative in mind, and there was a concern around whether or not if this is to measure physician behavior, that it should be based on ordering of the test. This was something we had debate over, and I think we'd be amenable to editing it if that was the only issue.
This is Kathleen. I do have a question about that, especially on this and another measure. Is it looking for performance of the whole team, looking at performance of physicians, looking at performance of the hospital? Which is supposed to be the focus?
The submission says that the level of analysis can be either individual or group clinicians or a facility. So there's several levels, potential levels of analysis for this one. But I guess in response to Dr. Scher's comment, and I will just disclose the fact that I was a practicing OBGYN for 20 years and I was frequently that ED doc, isn't it part of the doctor's performance to not only order the test but look at the result and incorporate that into the evaluation and decision-making process in taking care of the patient?
I agree with that. I think when this measure was developed, it was developed mainly with the PQRS system in mind, and that was the position that the American College of Emergency Physicians wanted to put in the measure, but I think we'd be amenable to changing that, because I think that's a very reasonable point of view.
Okay. When you did your study, how did you collect the data? Was it the presence of a pregnancy test result, or was it the order on the order sheet?
In the study that I did, we looked at both, and there were no cases where a pregnancy test was ordered and not performed. So
okay.
That was not the results were the same for that.
Okay. So you looked at both, though?
We did look at both.
Yeah. Any other comments from the workgroup members? Because essentially your preliminary review of this measure, three of you said, yes, it meets the important criteria, and three of you said no. So this is an area where we've got a definite discrepancy in thinking. So how can we help answer whatever questions you have or whatever concerns?
Lee, is Lee Partridge on the phone?
Yes.
Lee, this is Sarah. Why did you think that, forget about the evidence level, why did you think that this issue of pregnancy testing was not so important?
Oh, I don't have a problem with the importance. I had a problem with the, whether or not there was a real gap.
Okay.
I mean,
it is standard of care. That's obviously, it should happen. The question was, is it happening? If the results, if you had new data that said the result all across the country was that 95% of the time all the hospitals were doing it, then I wouldn't recommend that they be endorsed simply because we know it's the standard of care that's being adhered to.
But you're feeling that there isn't enough data to know that?
Yes.
Okay. Any other thoughts on the importance criteria from folks? Are there any additional questions or anything we can find out? I don't think we can create more data, unfortunately. All right. Then let's look at the next criteria, which is scientific acceptability. The first issue was around the specifications of the measures. Janet, do you have any thoughts about how this measure is specified? the numerator, the denominator, or any exclusions?
No, actually, I thought that the numerator being all patients, all female patients with abdominal pain. I'm sorry, I'm having to work off of a piece of handwritten paper for the moment. Is that for, all women, your numerator would be, number of patients who have a pregnancy test is ordered in the ED, and I guess we've talked about ordered versus performed.
Mm-hmm.
And the denominator being all women from childbearing ages, essentially 14 to 50. And having done an OBGYN residency, I can tell you that we've delivered women before the age of 14. Mm-hmm. So a denominator can be a childbearing age, and that may be something that's a little bit different regionally. The target population, I think, is appropriate. Again, the denominator time window, I've delivered 11-year-olds, so I know that we can change that age or at least discuss changing that age. And I think that the exclusion criteria was appropriate because a lot of patients, and there's actually very good data out there to support that if patients think they're not pregnant, about 98% of them truly aren't pregnant. And that's actually, there's been several studies in literature that have supported that. So I think in terms of reliability and the numerators and denominators, I think that's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
However, the pregnancy test, I actually went back to the original data on the pregnancy test sensitivity and specificity, and we all pretty much accept, at least for clinical practice, that it's got a very high specificity, a true negative is a true negative. But we also know that the sensitivity for true positives is a little bit lower, especially in rapid testing, urine, point of care testing, which is predominantly what we do when we take care of patients. Almost always we try a urine screen first, and then we confirm with urine if we have a positive or a questionable pregnancy test. So sensitivity and specificity of the test itself, and of course there's 8 million vendors out there, it's pretty well accepted, though sensitivity is less than specificity in this particular test. And I wanted to bring both of those discussions to the forefront, the age range, childbearing age range, and the test itself, the sensitivity and specificity of itself.
Okay.
I'd love to hear your comments.
Yeah. Any thoughts from the other work group members?
This is Dr. Kelly. I would agree with the age change, maybe down to age 10. I don't know what the data would show. But, again, I would agree that that would be a window we might be missing. And I also agree with the comment made that we don't know that this is going to have a huge impact out there as it is standard of care. And I did look for that in the data. I really could not figure it out. The only piece I saw was fact that 56% of ectopics were missed or around that number. And so I thought, well, that was a reasonable reason to at least consider implementing this nationwide, with the fact that we're missing so many.
Other thoughts from work group members? Okay, on the preliminary review, all of you rated the measure as passing the scientific acceptability criteria. I get a comment from Dr. Schur about the age.
So I think we had this discussion, and clearly we're in agreement about childbearing age can start younger. This was a question of sort of at what age, for a measure point of view, people thought it would be worth the sensitivity, specificity, how many of these patients are you going to, is that the age range where you want to measure? And you could look at that two ways. You could say you're going to be measuring lots of patients in whom this may not be applicable, but that also may be an age group where there's a greater risk because providers aren't thinking actively about pregnancy. So we decided 14, but I think if there was a strong reason to change it, it would be reasonable to do. It was really based on expert consensus. We didn't have a specific piece of evidence to choose one age over another.
Okay. Any other thoughts from the Committee on Scientific Acceptability? Any other questions you'd like to have addressed?
If it's considered standard of care for ER, do they actually have anything in your guidelines that would say what the age is that you should start? Because it would be helpful to have the measure follow a national guideline.
So there's an outdated guideline that was put together, and I don't have it committed to memory. It's a guideline by the American College of Emergency Physicians on evaluation of abdominal pain that has never been reviewed because they've switched the way that they write guidelines now. And I'm not sure if it has an exact age in it, but if it did, it probably was also based on expert consensus.
Sarah, this is Lee. Am I right? The age of puberty is dropping in this country?
Well, a little bit, but it's still, I think it's 12.7, am I right? I think it's the most recent number.
Okay. Would that be 12.7 years?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I live in the district, and we hear routinely about deliveries to girls who are 10 and 11.
11, yeah.
So that's average.
I guess I would recommend looking to see if there are any guidelines within the pediatric societies as well, because, if you were looking to set a number to kind of tag it to something else, it seems reasonable.
Okay. We'll see what we can find.
Anything else on scientific acceptability? Then let's move on to usability. The work group members generally rated this moderate to high. There was one vote for low. Janet, your thoughts on usability of the results of this measure to various audiences?
Sure. I was looking at it from the terms of a consumer, looking at their local hospital to see how their local hospital stacked up. Because oftentimes that's what I hear from our more sophisticated consumers is that, oh, well, your hospital has XYZ percent success or infection rate. And so I looked at it through the lens of how you look at your community resources, and oftentimes that's consumers and the patients. And I thought that they would be able to understand this pretty darn well because this pregnancy test is a ubiquitous part of female reproductive life. So I thought that was a very, at least meaningful for the patients, consumers. Getting back to that standard of care issue, I would be really anxious to know if, the local hospital reported an 86% rate of getting pregnancy tests with abdominal pain presentations. I think that would be quite disconcerting to me. So, again, that's just a hypothetical, but I think for meaningful and useful and understandable for most consumers, I think that it is reasonable.
Great. Any other thoughts from the work group?
Yeah, this is Kathleen. I was wondering, is there anywhere you'd find out the percentage of people who do have electronic medical records? Because otherwise this would require a chart review, and this isn't just for this measure, but is there any idea about that, like what the burden is?
So currently about somewhere between 30 and 50% of emergency departments, and that data is based on a national survey. It's about 2 years old. Mm-hmm. 30 to 50% had what you'd think of as a pretty comprehensive electronic medical record system. Higher percentages had different components of that. Order
after
entry.
The burden of looking this up for something that's already a standard of care, that is a consideration. If you
I think
have
we've
at
moved
least
into
half.
We've moved into the feasibility.
Let's just keep segue. That's a great segue. Let's just keep
motoring. Yeah. Any other issues around the feasibility?
This is Sarah. Can I ask a question again, that sort of basic question? Most of the measures we looked at in this set had a mixed report on whether the measure currently is or could easily be incorporated in an electronic medical record. Why are you asking this in the sense that, some people do these things electronically and some don't? I mean, how important is this to you all in your thinking?
Well, I think that we certainly, NQF's position is that we really do want to see progress towards measurement using electronic sources. And so measures that are much farther along in that pathway are probably, should earn a few extra points. as opposed to those that aren't really thinking about the fact that electronic sources are really going to be critical for ongoing feasibility of measurement. So, but again, none of these are absolutes, but they are factors to kind of weigh in with all the other aspects of the measure.
So if a measure, let's just take an outlier, if a measure isn't in any electronic system, but we still think it's important, that trumps, the importance trumps EMR.
Yes, I think that certainly the importance is it must pass criteria. The other is not so much so, but you do have to look at the totality of all the criteria.
Thanks.
Well, for example, you know, they said about 10 minutes per chart. Well, there's a lot of patients that go to the ED that are women between 14 and 50, so that would be a significant amount of charts to be looking through on a paper chart.
Yeah.
If this is already, again, this is already a standard of care, so you want to have a measure that's not only important, but, you know, it's going to help with the quality project, close a significant gap, et cetera, and this is a lot of time per record to find this out.
This is Dr. Sutherland, and just to talk to this EHR issue, if we were to do this effectively in an electronic record, this is not a routine data element. So you would have to do a custom build, and you would want to do a documentation questionnaire for all of those exclusions. So you would have to go through, does she have a hysterectomy, yes or no? Do you already know that she's pregnant, yes or no? In other words, if you wanted to do a very clean collection, you would have to do a custom build. That would be my opinion based on my knowledge of this.
And this is Kathleen again. The custom build is difficult. It's not
yes,
an easy
expensive.
Thing. I work at the big system with 28 hospitals and do a custom build. We have to get all 28 to agree. Then we have to get the cash to do it. I mean, it's just, it's no small matter.
Yep.
This is Lee again. Is this a measure in which you would accept the sampling methodology?
Yes.
Okay. Doesn't help. I mean, it might help a little, not a lot, but it might help.
I think, did they say 25 charts? Was one of those samples taken?
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay. Anything else about this? We've spent a good amount of time on this measure, hopefully to kind of get a sense of the criteria, but the issues you've raised are all very pertinent issues. If there's additional information we can obtain for you, or if the developers would like to respond to some of these issues in more detail prior to our November meeting, those avenues are available. So does anybody have anything more to say on this particular measure? The actual final evaluation and final recommendation will occur at our November meeting, but we certainly raised some important issues. Okay.
I guess this is Dr. Kelly. I just have one concern, and we sort of addressed it. I mean, this is standard of care, and the outcome really was inappropriate imaging for pregnant women. Is that correct?
I think it was rate of mastectopics, Dr. Scher.
So that was that's the main goal of this measure. In his evaluation study, Dr. Graf also looked at patients who received imaging prior to knowing whether or not they were pregnant as a potential adverse event.
Go ahead, sorry.
So that's a secondary piece of evidence for the measure.
So this is Dr. Kelly again. I saw where half that topics were missed in one study, but I guess I'm still looking at the significance of this in terms of missing ectopics. Because to me, I think the CT imaging dropped from 3% to less than 1%, and I didn't think that was a huge outcome making me want to implement this nationwide, but missed ectopics would be.
Right, so ectopics and missed ectopics are a relatively rare event, and so they did not have there were not enough in Dr. Graf's study to make a comment about the change in the number of missed ectopics. The appropriate testing did increase after it was low initially, and it improved after the QI program.
Any other thoughts on this measure before we move on to another one? Okay. Everybody ready to shift gears maybe a little bit? The next measure is Measure 582, Diabetes and Pregnancy Avoidance of Oral Hypoglycemic Agents. This is brought to us from Resolution Health. This measure identifies pregnant women with diabetes who are not taking an oral hypoglycemic agent. Who is assigned to this measure?
That would be me, Dr. Kelly.
Great, Barbara, super. You want to start talking about your thoughts on the importance criteria?
I can't not get into the webinar, so I'm using paper.
All right, I'm sorry.
I actually do think that there was a lot of data on importance, and I may have to look at the rankings, but I think most of us probably ranked it high in importance. Now I'll see if I can pull that up.
Now, four of the work group members submitted recording ratings, and there were two that were high, one is low, and one was insufficient data.
Oh, okay.
For impact.
So we do have some disagreement on that, I guess.
Yeah, there is a little bit of disagreement on it. Ultimately, putting together all of them, this is an area for discussion, the importance criteria. So in terms of impact, what are your thoughts on the impact?
Well, this is one of the studies, this is supported by studies that actually showed a significant impact. I'm trying to back it up with what I'm flipping through paper here. I apologize.
Would it be better to go to the 1B, opportunity for improvement?
Hold on, let me see if I can figure out impact here. Sorry, I do apologize. I just cannot get onto your webinar. I guess I'll have to talk to your IT people.
Okay. Sorry, Barbara.
It's okay. So it seems to me that the impact what was reasonably supported with the data presented.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not actually understand, and maybe someone could explain to me, 1B2, which was a summary of data demonstrating the performance gap.
Okay.
But
Alan, are you on the line?
Sorry, yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Did you want to explain the data you submitted under performance gap, the list of numbers?
Sure. So the way that we apply these measures is we have a number of clients, and basically the plans have different numbers of members in each of the populations. So what you see here is just the numerator and denominator with the compliance rates for each of those plans. So clearly the groups with the smaller numbers are less meaningful, but it just gives you an idea of the range of compliance among the different populations.
So this is Lee. So I'm looking at it, Barbara, and I have the same problem you have. It has a list of numbers. Each set of numbers represents a different health plan score. Is that right?
Right.
As I looked at that, I thought, is this a true performance gap? Because we've got a lot of 100%. Now, they were low numbers, but the range was 81 to 100%, and I just thought, I don't know if we're going to do much better with this one.
Any other thoughts from the work group members? Three of you rated it as medium, or moderate, rather, and one insufficient.
I guess it would be interesting to know whether or not there are particular characteristics of any of these plans that, for example, is there some possibility that the one that scored at 81.95, which actually has the largest number, drew a different segment of the population, or was in a different location where perhaps less access to endocrinologists was available? I'm just curious if we've got a disparity question here.
Yeah, this is Ellen. Certainly, that's possible. That's the case, but we didn't have the detail level data to answer those types of questions.
Is that something you could get, Ellen?
I can talk to our analysts and see if we can, you know, try to dig into that a little deeper. In terms of specialty distribution, I guess would that be sort of the first thing we'd want to look at?
Well, actually, population would be pretty critical, too. If you had a high incidence of either Hispanic or African-American population in the plans with the lower scores, for example.
Yeah, we were a little challenged with getting ethnicity data, but I can certainly check with our analysts and see what kind of data we can get.
Okay. So, Barbara, what do you think about 1C, the evidence criteria?
I thought the evidence was strong, and I do believe it's essentially standard of care. So I rated it as high.
Thoughts from anybody else in the work group?
So this is Laura. I actually don't think the evidence is all that great. I mean, I think that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that insulin is the way to go, but I think there's more and more data suggesting that for some patients, oral hypoglycemics are appropriate use in pregnancy. And I think even if you scroll down somewhere in here, I read, it's also in the ACOG guideline that it says the use of oral agents for control of type 2 diabetes during pregnancy should be limited and individualized until data regarding safety and efficacy of these drugs become available. So it's not suggesting that it doesn't necessarily work, and it gives you leeway in terms of whether or not to use it. And I think there are many people who stay on their oral hypoglycemics because that's about all the patient's going to do. So I'm not convinced that the evidence is absolute at all.
Well, this is Kathleen. I agree with Dr. Riley. I rated it as low because in reading the ACOG practice bulletin and the other opinion, I thought that there was a big gap in the evidence, and I did not think that was a strong evidence base to support this. I think the evidence is evolving.
Exactly. That's sort of how I thought about it, is it's not there yet.
This is Sharon. I pulled a citation because I felt this is an area I didn't know much about. So if you look out on the Excel file at 1C, there's some information there. It was a citation that looked at just this issue of using the oral hypoglycemic agents in pregnancy. So based on what I felt, I agree with the other two.
This is Sarah. I am the one in the group that didn't vote on this because I didn't understand what the measure even was. Could one of you, I won't take any time, there's just one of you in 25 words or less, tell me what this was about.
So essentially what, this is Laura, essentially what this is suggesting is that if you have type 2 diabetes, basically prior to pregnancy, and then you enter pregnancy, once you become pregnant, this is suggesting that all of those patients should be taken off of their oral hypoglycemics and placed on insulin during pregnancy. And that certainly has been for, you know, historically exactly what has been done, but I'd say more recently with, you know, newer oral hypoglycemics, as well as many more patients with type 2 diabetes, there has been greater use of oral hypoglycemic during pregnancy. But as you can imagine, with pregnancy, it takes a fairly long period of time to get the safety data that, you know, might make this normal clinical practice. So at the end of the day, the question of whether some type 2 diabetics can stay on oral hypoglycemics and still have reasonable glucose control and not have any adverse outcomes for themselves or their babies, I think is a bit of an unanswered question at this time.
Well, based on what you said, it says in the brief description of measure, it says, this measure identifies pregnant women with diabetes who are not taking an oral hypoglycemic agent. Based on what you just said, it sounds like what the measure is identifying pregnant women with diabetes who are using insulin, not are not taking, because not taking can mean either that they're doing nothing at all or that they're doing insulin. So it's not specific enough.
Right. This is Alan, if I may comment. So this is designed as what we call a quality profiling measure. So we design it so that a higher compliance rate is the target. So exactly as you're saying, we're trying to identify women who are pregnant and have diabetes who are not taking the agent. So a higher, if they're all doing as we would want, then the compliance would be 100%.
But I thought the issue was not whether or not they're doing something, but whether they're doing oral or oral hypoglycemic agents or insulin. It's not just that they're doing something. I thought the focus was on what they're doing.
Well, if they have diabetes and they're able to be controlled without taking insulin oral or oral agents, then they would still be compliant. It's just a matter of if they have diabetes and they're pregnant and they're taking the oral agent, that would make them non-compliant.
But where are you separating out the women who have diabetes who are taking neither oral hypoglycemic agents or insulin and basically are uncontrolled or unmanaged appropriately? In other words, they're taking nothing because they've just never taken anything or they've never been properly diagnosed. Where do you separate those out from either the numerator or the denominator?
Well, we're not getting at issues of control as measure because that would require, lab data. And this was, it wasn't designed as a level three measure, just using administrative data.
So now even I'm confused. So it sounds to me, am I not reading this correctly? It sounds to me like what you're saying would be a success, turn it a different way, would be a woman who had been on oral hypoglycemics or not, I guess, prior to pregnancy. She gets pregnant, and now she goes on insulin. Isn't that the success? Isn't that who you're trying to increase the number of?
That would certainly fall into the positive compliance rate, correct?
Right. So a woman who was on oral hypoglycemics prior to pregnancy gets pregnant and stays on her oral hypoglycemics is not compliant according to the way this is written.
Right.
Even if she's in good control. That's what I have an issue with.
Right. Well, that's another aspect of this same thing. I mean, there's three conditions. Having diabetes and not having it controlled, being on nothing, before pregnancy, during pregnancy, whatever. Then there's what you just outlined, which is where they were on oral and now they're on insulin. And then there's one where maybe they were always on insulin. But these different, there are three or four different sequences of prior status and then pregnancy status with regard to treatment. None and then the two options. And I just don't see how they're all covered in this measure.
I don't think they are all covered in this measure. And I'm suspecting that, the measurer can tell us, but that wasn't your intent, was it?
Right. I mean, again, if we had lab data and we could, or administrative data that qualified whether it was controlled or not controlled, which, is inconsistent with claims, then we would certainly want to segment that out, but we didn't have that ability based on just the administrative data.
So because you couldn't do that, then what you're doing is almost a proxy to that is basically saying insulin is better than an oral hypoglycemic, so you want to increase the number of people on insulin.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
But the, see, that's my point. That's a judgment call that I don't know that we have the data that supports that necessarily. We have historical practice that supports that, but we don't know that in that right now with all the oral hypoglycemics that are on the market that that's the case. I guess I'm having an issue with whether or not, I mean, it sounds to me like it would be punitive if, in fact, a provider or a patient decided to stay on an oral hypoglycemic, even if her sugars was were well controlled. That doesn't seem right.
Well,
and I don't know that there's data to support that change.
Right. I mean, there, there was the two pieces. One part is the control, which in general we would hope that insulin provides tighter control, but also the issue of they're still determining whether there's safety with oral agents. And so until that data is available to be conservative and switch to insulin.
See, I think that there's a problem with that because I think that it's not it would be in contrast to the statements that are to the guidelines out there. And as we just talked about with the last measure, it's nice to have guidelines that go along with the measure. This is one where the guidelines are telling you you could potentially do something different, and it's okay, yet here you would be penalized for it. That doesn't sound good, I don't think.
Can I ask it a different way? What happens with this measure when a bunch of women in an aggregate measure, even an individual case, pops up who is pregnant, with diabetes and not taking an oral hypoglycemic agent, and for whatever reason we think that she wasn't taking anything before pregnancy either?
She would still get pulled into the measure as a denominator for being having diabetes and being pregnant, but would be compliant because she's not taking oral agents.
Well, that's my problem, but she's obviously not compliant. There's an example of somebody who may be in very, who may really need help. They have uncontrolled, undiagnosed, whatever, unmanaged diabetes. And this measure puts them into a category of a success, in essence.
That is so true.
Right.
All right.
It's a very valid.
This is, Dr. Kelly, I have traditionally changed my diabetics in this situation to insulin. Can one of the obstetricians and gynecologists tell us how many doctors are choosing to use these agents? The oral agents?
I use oral. I mean, if a patient of mine comes in and she's well controlled and she's already on something, and her sugars are low, I see no reason to change her to insulin. You know, and obviously that's someone who's checking their sugars four times a day and they have good hemoglobin A1Cs. You're hard pressed to now have them sticking themselves. And there's some patients who just aren't going to do it. And I'd rather them take something than nothing.
Right.
So sometimes it's a judgment call, obviously.
Yeah, and when it's that much judgment, I'm just wondering how it works as one of these aggregate measures.
Well, I guess I'm changing my mind from my lot of evidence to not so much evidence.
Okay.
Because, if a standard of care that's reasonable and thoughtful, like the patient you just described, to me that sounds totally reasonable, and I don't think this measure is addressing that.
Okay. All right. I think we need to kind of move on a little bit, but we've certainly highlighted the issues around the evidence supporting this measure.
Reba, it's partly evidence, but I think at least my question is about the measure, not
okay.
Whether good evidence behind it. I still don't really understand the measure itself.
Okay. Well, do you want to have any? Do you want to talk about the scientific acceptability of the measure, the way the measure is specified, and its reliability and validity?
I'm not. Well, this is Dr. Kelly again. I guess I'm not sure if I'm back on the. I'm not sure this is an appropriate measure now. Now I'm changing my mind. I'm flip flopping. I'm not sure if we need to discuss the rest of it. What do the daughters say?
This is Laura Riley. I agree with Dr. Kelly. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot else to discuss. I have an issue with sort of the upfront piece of this, so it's hard to keep going.
All right.
It's not going to get any better.
I agree, Kathleen.
I agree.
This is Dr. Young. Mm-hmm. Based on the information that I'm hearing, It sounds like there had been some question about safety and efficacy of oral agents in the past, but the data has slowly come along that says, these might not be as unsafe as we thought. And while we still might not have that data, there's no compelling reason to push patients over into self-injecting with insulin if they are well controlled. That's sort of the what I'm hearing. Is that correct?
I think that that is what's happening in practice. Not in droves, but I think, people are making judgment calls based on a whole bunch of things and not just automatically switching people to insulin.
All right. Well, since time is flying and sounds like you've had a good discussion on that, let's move on to the next measure, 476. This is antenatal steroids. Now, this measure was endorsed during the last perinatal project, and the stewardship of this measure is now in the hands of the Joint Commission. So this measure assesses patients at risk of preterm delivery at 24 and 0 to 32 and 0 weeks gestation receiving antenatal steroids prior to delivering preterm newborns.
It's me. It's Laura.
Oh, great, Laura.
We talked about this a lot 3 years ago, and I think it's still a good measure. I think the things that concerned us before were how complicated it was going to be to get this information, and I think if people read through, the calculation is quite scary. But I think if I'm reading it correctly, there are enough databases such that this information can be obtained fairly reliably. Do you want to go through it systematically?
Well, why don't we just
impact and opportunity?
Yeah.
So in terms of impact, I mean, there's no question that it has a high impact. I mean, I think prematurity we know is a huge issue. A lot of short and long-term consequences. There's a lot of data which suggests that beta methasone given in a complete course, which is two doses, prior to delivery would significantly decrease the risk of respiratory distress as well as other sequelae of prematurity. It's hard to sort of argue with any of that. There's a lot of evidence. Anything else you want me to say about that?
No, just the opportunity for improvement. I see the Joint Commission says their aggregate performance is 64.9%.
Right. So, which suggests that there's clearly a gap there.
Right.
So, there's room for improvement, which I think is important.
Yeah, all five members of the committee rated this highly on all the sub-criteria and overall on the importance criteria. So,
yeah.
Given that, unless any of the other work group members want to offer anything, do we want to just briefly look at the scientific acceptability? Are there any issues or concerns from the work group members?
No.
Okay. Again, all five of those ratings were highs and yeses passing. Fourth one, the usability criteria, again, rated highly by all the work group members. Any questions or points of discussion for the work group?
This is Lee. I just had a question. I think it's more appropriate in the usability section than elsewhere. Some of this administration occurs prior to the pregnancy outside of the hospital, i.e. by a physician who's not on the hospital clinic staff or something like that. I just wondered, we're reporting it now as hospital-based data, and what kind of problem is it for the hospital to know whether it's occurred? I guess this is burden more. It's probably feasibility.
Okay, either one. Celeste or Ann, any thoughts?
Yes, in our specifications, we actually state that they can look at clinic visits or physician's visits or prior hospitalization, but it has to be documented in the medical record when the delivery took place.
So in other words, if you've got a situation in which the OB's record is available to the hospital, that's what they use to document it.
That or they take it, and actually it can be written anywhere in the medical record. We don't specify. So if it's in a progress note or the history and physical, or if they've given one dose prior to and then the second dose is recorded in the medication administration record, that's what they'd be looking for.
I guess I'm thinking back to my days when here, and I'm also in the District of Columbia, we have a protocol, which I'm afraid is still in place, that if you go into labor, you're taken to the nearest hospital where the record, your pregnancy care records may not be. And I was therefore curious about the burden issue.
Okay. All right. Anything on further on feasibility? I guess I'd like to hear just from the developers on the actual data collection and to what extent the data can be collected electronically.
A lot of the data elements can be, but there are some that are going to need to require manual abstraction. For example, looking for the fact that the full course of steroids were given would require a record review. Gestational age is something that if you have a computerized record, you might be able to pull that out, but at this point in time, it's something you have to look for in the medical record.
Okay. Any other questions from the work group for this measure? Any other discussion points you'd like to bring up?
Go ahead. Dr. Kelly, I agree with one comment, which was the antepartum care facility may not be the same as the delivering facility, particularly when you're delivering a premature baby. So that is something that we need to at least address under the feasibility and usability criteria, because I do think it's going to be a little bit of a struggle in some situations to get that data.
This is Dr. Sutherland. I guess I had a question about the exclusion of a diagnosis of fetal distress. Because I think the way the measure is written, when I looked at the ones that did not get steroids, I think 26% of them were cases where there was a diagnosis of fetal distress.
I think you mean fetal demise.
No, I think it may have been. In other words, they didn't wait to do the delivery for steroid time because there was concern about fetal well-being.
Well, if the way it is right now with this version of the manual, if there is documentation that the delivery occurred prior to the second dose of steroids, it's implied that they didn't get the full course and they're removed from the measure.
So is that considered a failure?
No, they're not a part of the measure because they weren't eligible to get two doses due to the precipitous delivery.
But if it wasn't precipitous, you did a C-section because of an abnormal heart rate tracing.
Same thing. They're delivering them before they can get the opportunity to give that second dose, so they would be removed from the measure. It would be an implied reason.
Okay.
Any other questions for this measure? Okay. Well, all right. We're speeding up a bit. The next measure is measure 477. This is under 1,500-gram infant not delivered at appropriate level of care. This was also a measure that was reviewed 3 years ago in the Perinatal Project. It's brought to us from the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative. And this is the number per 1,000 live births less than 1,500-gram infants delivered to hospitals not appropriate for that sized infant. So who is primary for that?
It's me, Dr. Sutherland.
Okay. Great, Sharon. Thanks. What are your thoughts on the importance criteria for this measure?
Well, looking at everybody's survey, it looks like they agreed that it is important. I think a lot of this has to do with factors other than medical factors, and I think a few of the folks brought those up. I think there's plenty of information that shows that I think there was the best was a 60% greater rate of survival in a level 3 NICU versus a lower level NICU. All of the data, when I looked up the actual studies, was based on observational information. The study that was done by Caswell, which was one of their citations, was a meta-analysis, and they looked at the adequacy of evidence. They threw out the majority of studies that did not feel that they had adequate evidence, but of those that they felt had good scientific validity, there was a strong correlation with a survival benefit at a level 3 NICU.
Right. right. Any other comments from the workgroup members on the importance criteria? Because you all did rate it pretty consistently high.
Well, this is Sarah. At some point, I want to discuss these sort of non-hospital or non-medical factors, because if our assessment is that the main factors influencing whether or not infants are delivered at the appropriate level has nothing to do with anything doctors control or, you know, the usual suspects in these measures, and it's all about, you know, underfunding of ambulances or, you know, weird hospital blah blah, I'm not sure the measure is, I don't know if it's not that it's important, but it may not be useful.
Just Dr. Sutherland, I could speak to that a little bit. What people may not be familiar with are some of the regulations, for example, things like EMTALA, which hospitals can be fined for transfer of pregnant women. And so there are a couple disincentives to transfer patients in a situation such as this. There's also the economic disincentive because they're going to lose the revenue from the delivery when the patient transfers and delivers elsewhere. And I know it's crass to bring up those issues. But
I think it's absolutely critical.
So that's where part of it is, you know, the question is at what level of authority will we be able to put pressure on institutions to do what's right for patients? And from a legal perspective, what kind of protections can we seek for specific situations like this in which transfer is critical for the patient, for EMTALA?
But I thought that EMTALA means that you need to evaluate the patient. You can't turn her away without seeing her, but that doesn't necessarily mean that once you evaluate her and determine that she's 24 weeks, that you can't transfer her to the appropriate institution.
Well, the definition says the patient's in labor. They can't be transferred. Now, obviously, we do it, but, you know, I don't know how much of the California experience has to do with this particular issue.
Do we have anybody from the measure developer on the line? Dr. Main? Elliot, are you there? He said he was going to call in.
Yeah, I think this is important because I just to make it overstate it, I think the idea of these measures in general is that, you know, people in a department or a hospital or a region will look at a number on one of these and say, gee, we can do better than that. That's important. Let's develop checklists. Let's develop, you know, programs in the EMR, whatever. And if this is about if this is being driven by factors outside of the usual levers of control and improvement and so forth, then it's not that it's not important, but it just won't do anything because the results don't go to the people who are making the decisions. Don't go to the hospital board or the, you know, physician, whatever. And if they're not the principal drivers of where women are transferred or if they're transferred, then we shouldn't do it.
My only other concern in reading this measure is that it excluded hospitals that did less than 50 deliveries per year, which generally speaking means it's a hospital without a maternity service. So by not tracking those hospitals, you lose the opportunity to improve triage of pregnant women from those sites because those patients are at the worst disadvantage if they deliver in a hospital without a maternity service and without any kind of specialized pediatric care. So I was just curious if anybody knows why we exclude those sites.
Great question.
Yeah. I think these are excellent questions we'll need to get our developer to address. Like I say, Elliot was supposed to be on the line.
This is Janet Young. From a pre-hospital perspective, since that is a little bit of my forte, oftentimes, especially in rural areas, capitated access hospitals that stay open and remain open simply for this very reason. We have an ambulance crew who is all BLS certified, who now have a preterm, even sometimes pre-viable patient in labor, and they're going to go to the nearest ER. End of discussion. Especially in places outside where you have a hospital, you know, every square mile, these hospitals oftentimes are doing emergency OBGYN management in less than ideal environment.
Mm-hmm.
in looking at the ratings by the work group beforehand, it rated it all highly for importance, highly for scientific acceptability, and highly for feasibility. But usability, I think, was the one where there is quite a variation, one high, three moderate, one low. And I think, is this the issue that you're concerned about, is the actionability of who can use this data to actually make improvements? Or is there some other issue?
This is Dr. Kelly. That was my issue. And I also had the same issue with the small hospitals because, well, in Colorado, we have a lot of small hospitals, and they're hampered by weather as well as their size and location to get the patient transferred in a timely manner. So I'm wondering if there's a way to put in the data, some assessment of when the transfers don't occur and why not, to be able to address those issues and try to improve the care overall.
Mm-hmm. This is Kathleen. There are only 84 hospitals in the United States that have less than 50 births per year that say they have an OB service. So it's not a small number. You know, there's 3,265 hospitals with the OB service, so it's a very small number they're excluding.
Say that number again.
There's 3,265 hospitals in the U.S. that have an OB service, and of those, 84 have less than 50 births per year.
But do all hospitals have to report this even if they don't have a maternity service?
No. Why would they be collecting quality measures on obstetrics if they don't have any OB patients?
Yeah, because if you look at, I'm in Ohio, so if you look at Ohio Hospital Compare, they track this on many sites that, again, don't really do OB, but it will show up as being tracked.
Well, in that data, there's only 42 hospitals in the United States that had any births that said they were not an OB service, did not have an OB service. So, you know, there's really
that's
not
that low reporting.
You know, so there's not that many in the entire United States that had a birth that didn't have an OB service. And those numbers were only 1 and 2 per hospital.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
This was not, this information is not from Elliot's submission, but we have found using data from birth records, which is the source for this one, and this gets into the feasibility area, it is sometimes difficult to access that data. Now, here you're reporting, but here the hospital is supposed to be reporting.
This is Elliot. I got sidetracked by Maternal Mortality Review Committee, which was scheduled at the same time here in California. I was thinking this was the Pacific Coast time rather than the East Coast time. So I'm sorry to get in here late. It is very extraordinarily easy to do with vital records, as was pointed out. And birth weight is a high reliability data element on a birth certificate. It's one of the best there is of all the different data elements. And we do have a gestational age floor, so that 20-weekers are not included. What we're working on is, in a number of states, already is the sort of free the data, making vital stats data available for quality improvement in real-time basis. We have probably 5 or 6 states already that have active programs in that, because that is the future, which is to use administrative data for and reduce the burden of data collection. So I see that happening actually more and more around the country, and I think that's a good thing to encourage for everybody's sake in terms of reducing burden and improving the quality of the administrative data sets.
This is Laura.
Yeah.
We're all on board with the measure, except we came into a stumbling block in the last, 10 minutes of the conference call. So where we were a little stuck was this question of whether things like the EMTALA rule, and things that are outside of the control of the provider or even the hospital, sort of how do you deal with that, and is there any way of getting the information from this to the people who actually make those rules? There's a little difference of interpretation about the EMTALA rule anyway, but, you know.
Sure. What's interesting is that when we've examined in California the under 1,500 gram births that occurred in non-level 3 hospitals, their average length of stay hospital A before birth was between 8 and 14 hours. So these weren't patients who came in and delivered, which is obviously going to happen everywhere occasionally. And there is so you're never going to get a zero rate on these. But there are a number of hospitals that just have high rates that are, two standard deviations above everybody else to really catch attention. And that's really the focus, is not to create that zero level, but to have over a threshold. And we were able to identify those kind of thresholds looking at all 300 or 280 hospitals in California that had more than 50 births showed. And actually, the hospitals that had issues were not in the rural areas. California has a large number of rural hospitals. They got their moms out. It was downtown L.A., where the level 3 hospitals were not far away, and it was economically driven that the moms were kept there and then the babies were transferred. So this is really turning what is a healthy person 2010 and 2020 measure into something that can be used as a hospital lever for quality improvement. Is having a public health measure hasn't really changed much. It's until you change the practices at the hospital level. So, no, you're not going to get a zero because there are going to be some mothers coming and delivered. But these are, it is impressive how different physician practice styles can change some of these measures, can affect some of these measures. Please.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question on that? Can you tell us what the principal factors are that affect whether or not a baby is delivered at the appropriate level? Is it within a physician's control or the hospital control, or is it county ambulance rules or whatever? What drives this measure?
It's largely the physician wanting to deliver the patient that he or she has cared for, and saying, well, it really doesn't make any difference, we'll just transfer the baby afterwards. Yes, there are some county hospital issues in which the mom may be taken to the local hospital, but they need to be able to triage and send them on to level 3 hospitals. This is about the whole issue of, do we believe regionalization of care is good? And that data is very strong. I gave a number of references for that. For these very low birth weight infants, that's well documented.
Right, that's not the question.
So that's the driver here, and it is, to a certain extent, economic.
Excuse me, which is the driver?
The driver here is physician practices and economics.
Well, a quality measure, I think, can, we hope, affect physician practice. Can you give us a scenario where how a measure like this would affect economics?
No. The economics are the physician wants to get the delivery fee, which he not get if he transfers the mother to another hospital.
So it's a physician
economics. And to a certain extent, there are some payer economics that are perverse incentives here as well, because they may have to pay more if the mother goes and delivers at a level 3 facility than at a level 1 facility.
Right.
So there are some perverse incentives in play here that we want to be able to address if this, for example, state of California is looking at this to be a Medicaid quality indicator on their dashboard. And then the managed Medicaid plan would have to report how they do on it. So that would be a plan-level report as well as the hospital-level report. And then you could start getting alignments in the correct direction, the incentive alignments correct. But it is certainly not expected to be zero for everyone all the time who's not a level three. There's going to be some moms who come in and deliver. That's the nature of obstetrics. But it shouldn't be so skewed, and it shouldn't be a large number.
Thanks, Elliot, very much. Does anybody else in the work group have any other questions about this measure? Okay, then why don't we go ahead.
I apologize for coming in late on that.
Not a problem. Thanks for being here, Alex. Appreciate it. Okay. The last measure to discuss today is Measure 1746. This is a new submission. This is intrapartum antibiotic prophylaxis for Group B strep. This is from Massachusetts General Hospital. The percentage of pregnant women who are eligible for and receive appropriate intrapartum antibiotic prophylaxis for Group B strep. Whose measure is this?
Kathleen.
Kathleen, great. Your thoughts.
Was this submitted in the last go-round 3 years ago? I seem to recall this.
If you recall, there were several measures around Group B strep that were submitted, and if my memory is correct, the major reason none of them were put forward was because it was felt that the guidelines had been in place for significant period of time and performance was generally quite high across the board, and there was limited opportunity for improvement.
That's my recollection. However, the data here suggests that there is opportunity for improvement.
But the last time we didn't have that data.
Okay.
So we had that. So when we had the discussion, oh, it's great, everybody said it was great.
Yeah.
There was nothing to say that they weren't right.
Okay.
So that's why it got, that's why it went away.
Yeah, I was surprised to see this again, but then when I looked at the data, I thought, well, wait a minute. So it does. All right, so anyway, this is, there are guidelines that offer your recommendations for how to handle the situation, and based on the evidence in terms of a opportunity for improvement, it looks like there is some opportunity for improvement. And there's, it's broken down between those who are term and those who are preterm, and it looks like that everybody does not get appropriate chemoprophylaxis. So I think there are, you know, some opportunities for improvement, and I guess that data wasn't available last time. So I thought it was important on that perspective. And then looking at the ability to collect the data, well, first of all, there are national guidelines. And, you know, from the CDC, and then they have also been adopted and summarized by ACOG. And so I thought that was appropriate, and they're easy to understand. We know that if they get the appropriate antibiotics, more likely than not, you know, higher more likely than not to, it's going to work. So that was helpful. And it appeared that the numerator and the denominator were appropriate. There's appropriate exclusions. I think the data can be easily collected. It still has, you know, may require some manual chart review depending on the level of EMR at the individual hospital. So, you know, I thought this was high in all areas of analysis and was very supportive.
The ratings from the work group are in generally quite high. Also, as well, and agree with you, Kathleen. Do we have anybody from the developer on the line with us?
Yeah, this is Jeff Ecker.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Are there any other comments from the work group? Any questions for Jeff? I guess the one question I would have is this, are you intending for this measure to be stratified by term and preterm birth?
It's amenable to doing that, but
important for both preterm and preterm. So if your group said, boy, a gap of 13% isn't enough, we want a gap of 35%, then you focus on preterm. But the numbers are such that the absolute numbers are that the 13% of terms that are missed are going to be a larger group.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that it should not be just for preterm. I thought that the opportunities for improvement were significant for both groups. I was surprised to see these data.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts from any other work group members? Are there any questions about the feasibility of the measure? Is this a chart review measure? Is there electronic data sources?
It is a chart review measure, except for those places that are, you know, interested in looking at it and have configured their EMRs or other systems to capture the data. So, for example, here it's something that we can capture readily because we're interested in focusing on it. And perhaps if enough groups like yours were interested in it, then it's relatively easy to wire into the system.
We had some conversation about the ease of adapting EHRs earlier. Anybody else want to comment on that?
Yeah, this is Steve. I would think your exclusions might be a little tricky, particularly the second one. How do you know that this is a planned C-section? Just not sure how much of that kind of information is captured in a chart.
Right. Well, they're scheduled.
Again, it depends on the system and the chart, but
if you have a hospital where they document that a scheduled delivery is always a C-section.
No, a scheduled delivery is not always a C-section, but C-sections may be scheduled deliveries without labor. I mean, that's going to be germane to other measures that you all will look at on other phone calls, like the less than 39-week elective delivery measure.
Right. I assume ditto with regard to the screening negative of 35 to 37 weeks you would pick up presumably from the medical record. Of pregnancy related of care prior to delivery.
Yes.
Again, it would require you to have access to that information. But we've discussed that in the context of another measure earlier today, and apparently it's feasible.
Sure. I mean, it depends on, for example, here, not everyone's going to have the same medical record, but here, because we're interested in looking at whether or not folks got appropriate GBS prophylaxis, we asked folks to enter as part of delivery information whether they were at risk for GBS sepsis, and if so, what was given and when. So we don't have to go back to...
You asked the patient?
We asked the providers who were caring for the patient.
Right.
But part of the quote-unquote good care behind this practice in the first place is knowing what their GBS status is when they arrive on labor and delivery. So, it's important for obstetrical units to be able to transmit that information from the office to the hospital or from the lab to the delivery system. Because the CDC has shown in their studies looking, at their ABC surveillance, they've shown that that's where things fall through the cracks, is that the provider on labor and delivery doesn't know the woman's status at the time they're deciding whether or not she needs antibiotics, and those are the missed opportunities.
This is Sharon. One of my questions for the developer is looking at the issue of false negatives. I know that the citation from Van Dyke was listed, and it said 61% of the infants with group B strep disease at term had negative cultures. And I wondered if you'd seen the article that was put out by Intermountain. It was back in 2009. They looked at, I think, 127,000 deliveries, and that a significant number of the babies that had GBS were actually mothers that were cultured and culture negative. And I was just curious to see, because this measure would completely miss that opportunity. I'm just curious to see what your comments would be.
Well, in some sense, there's no way around that opportunity, and of course, that's exactly what you'd expect, because ideally, the folks that culture positive are all going to increasingly get antibiotics. And so GBS is going to develop in those that, you know, were false negatives. If you target an effort on treating the positives, then the disease is going to be left in the false negatives.
Because if I understand it, we're really not treating risk factors anymore. We're just treating culture results.
Exactly.
So I'm just curious about your opinion about that. Should we be doing a measure that actually involves both?
No. Since about 2002, CDC, based on comparative studies, has endorsed a culture-only approach because the evidence showed it performed better. No, I wouldn't endorse a mixed approach, in part because it would kind of contradict what were our widespread recommendations, but in part because those recommendations were themselves evidence-based.
This is Reva. I just wanted to ask the developer to clarify, when on the measure specifications, under the denominator details, you talk about the population must be further restricted on the basis of the following and all the stuff with the cultures. Then under unknown GBS status, delivery less than 37 weeks, amniotic membrane rupture equal to 18 hours. Do you mean greater than or equal to 18 hours? And also intrapartum temperature greater than or equal to 100.4?
Sure.
Yeah. Just, again, we'll want to have you correct that.
Sure. Glad to do it.
Yeah. Any other comments from the work group members in terms of this measure? You talked about feasibility, usability. Okay. All right. Well, we've just come in about time. We've gone through five measures. We've looked at the preliminary evaluations by the work group members. You've had an opportunity to share notes and thoughts about these measures in preparation for our meeting on November 29th and 30th. There were a few questions raised on some of the measures, and we will try to see if we can, you know, work with the developers and get some of those addressed a little more in more detail if possible. Is there anything else that the work group members feel you need to prepare for the November meeting where you will be presenting sort of the pros and cons of these measures to the entire steering committee?
This is Janet Young. I actually sent you an email while we were on the phone asking for those files that we just looked at on the webinar to be sent out individually. I could not find them on our website, and I'm sorry about that. So it would be helpful for those of us who are a little less computer savvy to perhaps get those in a either PDF or a separate email, please.
Will do. Thank you very much for that.
And the other issue is that I'd love to be able to have the measure developer, the initial measure developer, identified so that if we do have questions, we can actually get in touch with that person either by email or telephone so that we can discuss where they got their initial database. Because rather than reinventing the wheel of the work that was already done by the initial measure developer, my goal is to kind of go above and beyond that.
All right. If you could give me offline, maybe, Janet, you could give me some specifics and we can help figure out the best way to do that.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. There were operator?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. I know there were a couple of participants. We need to open the line to see if there are any comments from any of the participants on the discussion we just had.
Okay. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment today, please press star 1. Again, if you are on a muted line, you can press star 1 and I'll open your line. And I have no one in my queue at this time, but I'd like to remind everyone it's star one.
Okay. All right. If there are no comments, we're just a few minutes before. I want to thank everybody on the work group. This is sort of the first of the four work group sessions that we'll have over the next 2 weeks in preparation for our meeting in the end of November. Suzanne and Jean and I are here to help the steering committee with whatever it is you need to do these evaluations. Suzanne, do you have anything specific to...
Nope, just if you've flagged that you had an issue with SharePoint, please give me a call or an email after the call, and we'll try to figure out what's going on. As I mentioned before, this is brand new technology at NQF, so we're doing a lot of troubleshooting, and we want to help it work, make it work for you. So just let me know.
Suzanne, do you think we need to meet with the committee afterwards?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we're all in pretty good shape. Thank you all, especially the work you've done over the last few days to get the ratings in so that we could look at them in an aggregate to see where the issues were for the work group. That's an important part of this. And if you have any issues or questions in anticipation of the meeting at the end of November, feel free to get in touch with us at any time. But I think we're probably concluded for today, unless there are any further questions.
I have no further questions over the telephone.
Great. All right. With that, then, I'll wish you all a very good day, and we'll look forward to seeing you in person in November. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
That does conclude our conference call today. Thank you all for your participation.